You're listening to The Sound Off. The Sound Off. With the Solomonster. Solomonster.
I know Natalia is your type of woman. Did that feel a little bit?
What?
No, just saying.
Are you an idiot?
No, I'm just making an observation.
Now it's Ric Flair, and y'all pay homage to the man. Woo!
This is making me sick.
This is a Royal Rumble weekend edition of the Sound Off, episode 144 on SCScoops.com. Saturday, January 29th, 2011. I am the Solomonster. We're going to get to the Royal Rumble and all that good stuff in a second. We'll run down the card, get predictions, talk about Raw from Monday night, some shenanigans on the TNA European Tour involving Ric Flair. But the first thing I want to start out with here is the big news that I saw last night, that Stone Cold Steve Austin will be returning to WWE, and he is going to be the official host of the new season of Tough Enough, which, of course, will premiere the night after WrestleMania on the USA Network. The show is going to be similar, I guess, to the very first season of Tough Enough all those years ago, in that they're going to have, I think, 12 people all cooped up in a house. The house is going to be located, I think, in Los Angeles, which, of course, is where Austin lives. He switches back and forth between L.A. and his Broken Skull Ranch in Texas, but he lives out in L.A. because of his acting career. So Austin's going to host Tough Enough. When I heard this, I thought this was a great announcement. Stone Cold has not really done much with WWE recently. He's made the odd appearance here and there. But they have him under contract, and they pay him pretty good money, specifically to keep him away from signing with TNA or any other wrestling organization. And so if you're paying the guy, and you've got this new show, and you're looking for some star power, and obviously you're not going to have Al Snow come back as the head trainer and the kind of the head mentor, if you will, of Tough Enough. Either, you know, you don't want to go back to that well, or even if you did, it wouldn't matter because Al Snow is currently working for TNA backstage as a road agent. So Austin is the host, and what makes me wonder here is what exactly entails the job of being the host of Tough Enough? I don't think the first Tough Enough had a host. You had a couple of characters, which included Al Snow. Al Snow, maybe by default, could be considered the host, but he was the head trainer. He was not the host. So perhaps this show will be a little bit different. They have not said anything about head judges or anything like that. I would assume there will be at least a few. So I don't really know. The press release that they put out by WWE and USA Network, I'll just read part of this here. It says, Steve Austin will share his intimate knowledge, experience, and flair for the stage as one of the most popular figures in WWE history to a group of individuals looking for a once-in-a-lifetime shot to become the next superstar or diva. Austin will mentor the diverse group of men and women who will live, train, eat, and sleep under one roof in a house in Simi Valley, California. Each week, the contestants will battle it out in a series of unique challenges designed to test such characteristics as showmanship, creativity, athleticism, and desire, just to name a few. So that makes me think that perhaps Austin is going to be the centerpiece of the show as the, quote, host and maybe the head trainer. I don't know how much Austin can do physically in the ring with these guys, but I guess we'll see. They haven't announced many details beyond that, and the show is still a couple of months away. So I'm sure this was the first kind of big bang they wanted people to know about, and we'll find out more in the coming weeks. I think, again, great announcement. I'm glad to see Steve doing stuff with WWE again. He's a great TV personality, even if he can't actually wrestle. And if we see Austin kind of switch between being the entertaining guy that he can be, especially on Twitter. If you're not following Austin on Twitter, Steve Austin BSR is his Twitter handle. He is one of the funniest guys that you'll find. So if that shines through, and at the same time, if we see some of the old Austin, you know, perhaps showing some tough love to these guys, that would be kind of cool. I really think that he could do a good job on a show like this. And I'm looking forward to Tough Enough. Like I said, the only thing that I'm bothered by is, I know it's only for 10 weeks. There's no guarantee that they'll renew it and bring it back after that. But you now have a three-hour block of WWE programming each and every Monday night, which is great if you're a hardcore, diehard WWE fan. And I'm a fan, don't get me wrong. But I still think 3 hours is too much. I can't help but think that, you know, Tough Enough might work better on a different night. I know why they're doing it. But we'll see. April 4th is the premiere.
Now,
let's get down to business here. The 2011 Royal Rumble coming up this weekend on pay-per-view. Arguably, it's the company's second biggest pay-per-view show of the year. And it's the unofficial kickoff to the road to WrestleMania. This is typically one of the most fun, most successful periods that WWE will have in a calendar year. Their ratings generally go up, although I think that's also in large part because football season comes to an end. So they'll see a somewhat of a spike in ratings, of general interest in the product, and a lot of that is tied to how good the build is to WrestleMania. When they had that magnificent build to WrestleMania a couple of years ago, and actually I shouldn't even say that, I think what I'm thinking of is last year. I remember the last build to WrestleMania, mainly with Michaels Undertaker, but even with Cena, Batista, and some of the other stuff they were doing, was pretty damn good. And I can't say I'm all that impressed with how they're building their way towards WrestleMania right now. I'm not even sure they know what many of the top matches are going to be. I know that as of this past week, Vince McMahon apparently was telling people that Undertaker and Wade Barrett is his WrestleMania main event. I find that very hard to believe. I mean, I'm sure Undertaker and Barrett, there's a very good chance that match will happen. Undertaker and Barrett as the main event, that I don't know about. But apparently he's telling people that. So, not impressed by that, but, you know, the Rumble is an opportunity for them to perhaps start some new feuds heading into WrestleMania or continue some existing ones. You know, are they going to continue the feud with John Cena and CM Punk? Are they going to shift that over to something else and just move on? I don't know. We'll find out this Sunday. Now, they haven't announced all 40 names for the Rumble, nor will they. They're going to have some surprises. That's what we keep hearing. And every year, people wonder, is there going to be a surprise entrant or two? Well, you've got 40 people in the Rumble this year, and I'm almost positive there's going to be at least two or three different surprises. I would be stunned. I would be nothing short of stunned if Triple H was not in the Rumble this Sunday as a surprise entrant. I know Triple H did an interview a couple of days ago and was saying that he's targeting the spring for a return. I call bullshit on that. Spring, by the way, would be late March at the earliest. And again, he's already being advertised for a Madison Square Garden house show on March 19th. He's got a movie coming out next month. He is going to be back a lot sooner than that. And it would stun me if he wasn't in the Rumble on Sunday. I've seen a couple of different news items about Booker T. There were some news reports going back several weeks that he was in negotiations of some sort with WWE for a comeback, maybe even part-time, and then we didn't hear anything about it again. And all of a sudden, Booker T canceled some appearances that he was supposed to be making at an event this weekend. That by no means does that mean he will be in the Rumble match. But again, a lot of people seem to think Booker T may make an appearance in the Rumble this Sunday. Great Khali, there's another name to keep in mind. Great Khali's been off WWE television for many months. He was filming a reality show. I think it was the Indian equivalent of Big Brother in India. I think he came in second, actually, on that show. And I would expect Great Khali to be back on TV soon. Why not put him in the Royal Rumble? I'm not his biggest fan, but it would be a surprise entry. There may have been a couple of other news bits. I've actually avoided them. I actually don't necessarily want to know all of the potential surprise names. There are some things still that I love to be surprised by. Triple H seems like a given. Booker T, I've read that. If there's been any other names floating around, I've avoided it. You know, I care not to know all of the potential names. I'm sure many of them are the usual ones. You know, I'm sure Jimmy Snuka and Roddy Piper and the Honky Tonk Man and Sergeant Slaughter. All these guys, I'm sure, are being at least considered. Wouldn't shock me to see them in there. You know, personally, they don't really do anything for me. Another interesting name, though, to keep in mind, and I haven't read anything about this, but I was jaw-jacking on Twitter back and forth with somebody about the possibility of Bret Hart making an appearance in the Rumble. You know, Bret's kind of in limbo right now. He has a good working relationship with WWE, but there's nothing on the table. He's not even sure he'll be at WrestleMania this year. He would love to if he was asked. Could Bret be a surprise entrant in the Rumble? Sure. Bret showed me a lot more than I would have expected in the ring. At SummerSlam in September, when he participated in that trios match at Madison Square Garden, my only concern, I guess, and the reason I question whether Bret Hart would actually be in the Rumble, Bret Hart is not winning the Royal Rumble, and therefore to be eliminated from the Rumble, one must be thrown over the top rope and have both feet touch the floor. I suppose there are safe ways to go about doing this You know, they protected Bret very well at SummerSlam, for example, and in many of the matches that he was in. But how the hell are you going to throw Bret Hart out over the top rope? It just seems to me it would be a little bit of a risky move. It might even be hard for him at his age, at this stage of the game, to even either leap over or be knocked over the top rope, unless somebody press-slammed him out. I just can't visualize him being dumped out of the ring that way. So, I don't know. You know, it's just a thought. I have not heard word one about Bret Hart being there, but if he was, it wouldn't shock me completely. Now, the big question is, who will win the Royal Rumble? We all speculate about this every year. People make predictions. I don't remember what my prediction was last year, although I'm sure it wasn't Edge, so I'm sure I was wrong. Who do I think is going to win the Royal Rumble this year? My gut still tells me John Cena is going to win this thing. Do I want John Cena to win? Hell no. I do not want John Cena to win. No offense to John, but he's won the Rumble before. He still pushed down everybody's throats as the top guy in the company, even when he's not the champion. He's pushed a hell of a lot more than The Miz, even more than Randy Orton. He is still the top guy. And I just don't care to see John Cena win another Royal Rumble. He is at a stage where he doesn't have to win. He does not have to win the Rumble. There is much to be gained by other people winning the Rumble. And I'm not even talking about just young guys. You know, I don't want to necessarily see Christian make a return and win the Royal Rumble. As much as I love Christian, it's not going to happen. I don't think he's ready to come back anyway. There's some question, I think, whether or not he'll even be back in time for WrestleMania. But it just seems to me that, you know, Cena would be the most logical choice, I think, out of everybody in there, without knowing the names yet of all the 40 participants. Now, I will go on record and say this. I think John Cena is going to win the Rumble. I could be wrong. But even more than my John Cena pick, I don't know why, but something tells me that number 21 is going to walk away with this thing. I don't know why. I don't know why this number popped in my head. I really don't, but a couple of days ago it did, and I'm just going to throw it out there, and that's my prediction. Whoever comes out number 21 in the Royal Rumble on Sunday is going to win the whole thing. I have nothing to base this on. This did not come to me in a dream. I did not see a psychic. You might think I'm psycho, but number 21, whoever that may be, I pick number 21. Lucky 21. You've got the World Heavyweight Championship on the line. Edge defending against Dolph Ziggler. Now, this is a big match for Dolph. I think I said this last week. All eyes are on him. If he comes through with a great match this Sunday, there could be bigger things in his future. There's potentially the possibility for him to even rematch with Edge at WrestleMania for the title. I wouldn't expect Dolph to win. They've added this stipulation. I don't know why. I don't know what purpose it serves. I guess it adds a little bit of drama to the match. But as per Vicky Guerrero on SmackDown Friday night, Edge is banned from using the spear. And if Edge uses the spear on Dolph during their match on Sunday, he will automatically lose the match on a result of a disqualification and be stripped of the championship. Dolph will win the title if Edge uses the spear. Now, could they do a fuck finish where Edge uses the spear, he loses his head, or it happens by accident, and Dolph accidentally wins the title? Sure. I'm not expecting them to do that, but what good does that do Dolph Ziggler? I mean, it's almost similar then to how Sheamus won his first title when he basically just shoved John Cena off the ropes at the TLC pay-per-view through a table and won the championship essentially on a fluke. I don't really see what good that would do Dolph if you have some sort of fucked up finish like that. So, you know, I would just have a straight match with a clean winner. Even if Dolph doesn't win, if he has a strong performance in this match, it looks pretty damn good, and the crowd is into his match, because the crowd is going to have as much to do with that as anything. There could be big things in his future, and I'm a Dolph Ziggler fan. I'm a Dolph Ziggler convert. You know, I was never a real fan of his, and I'm still not a fan of his shitty name. But from the matches I've seen him in over the last couple of months, whether it was with Daniel Bryan or if it was with Kofi Kingston, who are both good workers, so, you know, maybe he needs to be in there with a good worker to have a good match, but he's had some pretty entertaining matches. He takes pretty good bumps. He's fun to watch in the ring. Personality-wise, he's pretty cookie-cutter, I will say that. But that's blame WWE for that, because to them, everybody has to look the same and sound the same. His interviews aren't the greatest in the world, but, you know, they're acceptable. So, big match for him on Sunday. I think Edge walks away with the title. We have Randy Orton and The Miz for the WWE Championship. This feud just is not doing it for me. God bless The Miz. I'm a fan of his, but I don't know. He has not had the best reign as champion so far. I know they're trying, but they're not trying hard enough. I mean, I know in WWE being a heel means you're a chicken shit, but still, he's come off a little too much like a pussy. He shouldn't be as much of a pussy as he is. He's been too pussified, is I think the word I'm looking for. I know I just made that up. He has been pussified by WWE, and they tried to make him a little tougher at the beginning of the year when he had that win over Morrison in the Falls Count Anywhere match, which was a very good match. In large part because of Morrison, but Miz did fine. Miz really needs a strong performance, and what I mean by that is he needs to come out and not be running scared of Randy Orton, and most importantly, he needs to win this match, and he needs to win it in a convincing way. He cannot win on a fluke. He cannot walk out and take a count out. He cannot have Alex Riley, interfere and help him win the match. I'm sure Riley will get involved in some way, but Miz needs essentially a clean win over a main eventer. He has not had that yet. I mean, he beat Randy Orton the first time to win the title, but again, Orton was hurt. He wrestled a match. I would hardly call that a fair win. But it just seems like every other match he has, unless it's with a John Morrison, who's a mid-carder, Miz either is afraid or he can't get the job done on his own. You can't take somebody like that seriously as champion unless they somehow at some point can get a real win over a main event guy. People see Randy Orton as a main event guy. Randy Orton is protected. He's probably one of the most protected guys in the company, aside maybe from Cena, maybe more so. I feel like I've seen John Cena do more clean jobs than Randy Orton. If Miz can beat Orton, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. And I'm also tired of this feud. So if Miz can beat Orton fair and square and move on to another feud with John Cena or whoever he's going to feud with heading into WrestleMania, I would love that, because I am through with the Randy Orton Miz feud. I've seen enough of it. It's not lighting my world on fire, and Miz needs this win. I'm going to go with the Miz, retaining the title. I'm sure that it's not going to be a clean win, but he needs it. He needs it in a big way right now. And I think the only other match officially announced is for the Divas Championship. I believe it's Natalya defending in a handicap match against both members of Le Cool, which leads me to something I wanted to talk about from Raw this past Monday night. So let's just get into some Raw thoughts here. So Natalya came out to defend her championship on Monday night against Melina. Now, normally with these Divas matches, I admit, I will sometimes tune out, either in my mind, I just kind of tune it out, or I literally change the channel, because these matches don't mean anything. Again, they give the women 2 minutes, if that. They're treated like a joke, and so I look at it as a joke. But I watched this match, and I'm glad I did, because for the time they were given, I thought they had a pretty damn good match. There was one point where Melina almost killed herself. I think it was on a hip toss, and she almost spiked herself into the mat. I think that was her fault. But aside from that, Melina even had this move that she used. It was a submission hold during the match that was very impressive looking. Not as impressive as the finish. Now, I've talked before, people I think way, way back when on some of the early episodes maybe even would send in questions about the sharpshooter and how badly people like The Rock would do it. And it's true, The Rock, as great as that guy was, God bless The Rock, I have never seen a person apply the sharpshooter in such an awful fashion as I did when The Rock would use that move. Because The Rock included the sharpshooter in his arsenal when he was wrestling. You know, you go back and watch a Rock match in 2000, 2001, 2002, he was using the sharpshooter. You know, him and Bret Hart are good friends. But he didn't know how to do it. He would put the hold on, and he would stand up. He would not sit back down. He had this pained expression on his face, like he was in more pain than the person who was actually in the hold. It was comical. You couldn't take it seriously. And so I'm watching this match, and I see Natalya put Melina in the sharpshooter. And first of all, she sits back. She applies the move the way that it needs to be applied. It looks great. but then she takes it one step further and actually continues falling backwards until she is completely back. That looked fucking awesome. That was a really cool visual, and I'm sure the reason they did it, Melina is a very flexible person. Most people would not be able to or willing to take the sharpshooter like that. Melina was, and more power to her. It looked, as a finish, it looked phenomenal. I already love the finish because if you paid any attention, Natalya basically stole, or they booked her to steal, the finish to the Bret Hart Mr. Perfect match at SummerSlam 91, which was one of my all-time favorite matches. If you think back to the Bret Hart Mr. Perfect match, at the end, you know, Bret Hart got distracted by Mr. Perfect's manager, the coach, Jim Tolos, and was knocked down, and Mr. Perfect gave him a stomp to the abdomen, picked up Bret's legs almost like he was going to give him a sharpshooter, and instead Mr. Perfect dropped a leg drop right across his balls, basically. And the second time when he went to do that, Bret grabbed Perfect's leg on the way down, and while laying horizontal on the mat, began folding up his legs like a pretzel and turned him over into the sharpshooter and won the Intercontinental belt. It was a great finish. Madison Square Garden went fucking apeshit for it. It's one of those things that you never forget. I remember almost every aspect of that match vividly. That's a match, mind you, from 1991. I was a lot younger. But if you were to ask me what happened in the finish to this or that match on Raw this past week or 2 weeks ago, I couldn't fucking tell you. I don't know what that says, but yeah, they borrowed from that finish, which I thought was really cool, and then watching her apply the sharpshooter that way, I love the end of this match. Now, let me tell you what I didn't like from this match, and maybe some people will think I'm just getting carried away with this, but I don't really give a shit. It's my podcast, and so I'm gonna say what I mean. I'm going to say what I feel. I know Michael Cole is booked in the way that he's booked. He's booked a certain way. It's a character that he portrays. He can't possibly be this much of an asshole in real life. He's doing what he's told to do by Vince McMahon, okay? I understand that. I still don't think he's a great wrestling announcer, but as far as the character, I understand it's a character that he's being told to play. Now, during the match between Natty and Melina, he made a comment. He made a comment that Natty was hefty. He basically said, Natty is fat. And, you know, Jerry Lawler, of course, is playing devil's advocate or you know, whatever. He's basically telling Michael Cole to shut up. He's disagreeing with him. And that's all well and good. But when he said that, it really, really pissed me off. It really pissed me off. And I know I shouldn't be pissed at Cole. I should be pissed at Vince McMahon. And Kevin Dunn and Brian Gewirtz and the fucking morons who basically book and script this show. But it really, really got on my nerves. More so than I thought it would. More so than it should. I really shouldn't let any of the shit get to me, but it did. You know, it just made me think, I'm sorry all the divas in the company don't look like Skeletor. You know, God forbid that you should have a few women on the roster who aren't stick figures. Who aren't all skin and bones, like Michelle McCool, for example, or Kelly Kelly. I look at Natty personally, and I see a normal woman. I don't see a woman who is rail thin. True, she's got a little bit of meat on her, but by no means do I look at Natty and think, "Wow, that's a hefty woman right there. That's a fat woman." I don't think that. And it would be one thing if it was part of a storyline with one diva. Like, I understand Lay Cool, their whole gimmick is that, you know, they're flawless and everybody else is fat and ugly and disgusting. But, you know, WWE has exhibited a pattern of this shit over a long-ass time. This is not an isolated incident. Let us not forget the Piggy James angle, which pissed a lot of people off. And that bothered me too, but not as much. Because it was the first time they did it as part of an angle. It was very mean-spirited, don't get me wrong. It was a shitty thing for them to do, but at the end of the day, whatever, it was a storyline. Then there's Vicky Guerrero. Now, Vicky Guerrero is a woman who has worked very hard in recent months to lose weight. Vicky was an overweight woman, and they would mock her and crack jokes about her on TV, and people would laugh, and she was a punchline. And then she went, and she lost over 30 pounds, and I think she's still losing weight. And I look at Vicky Guerrero now, and whatever your opinion is, if she's an attractive woman or not, that, you know, teach their own. But the point is, I don't look at Vicky anymore and think to myself, wow, this is a woman who needs to be ridiculed because she's so fat. No, I could find a million different ways to ridicule Vicky Guerrero. Her voice is like nails on a fucking chalkboard. She's annoying. Her gimmick is great. I'm just saying, though, I could come up with many other things other than her weight to criticize her about as a character. And still, every single week, Vicky goes out there, 30, 35 pounds lighter, whatever she is, and they just mock her unmercilessly for being fat and disgusting and basically being a fat pig. They're not going to come out and call her that, but that's basically what they're saying. So the Vicky Guerrero stuff continues. Now, they're doing the same shit with Natalya by having their lead announcer go out there in full character mode and basically say, hey, the women's champion, she could stand to lose a couple of pounds. She's pretty fucking fat. That's basically what they're saying. And it just really gets on my nerves that you have these people who work in that company in a writing capacity, whatever capacity it may be. And this was always a criticism levied, and still is a criticism levied, for example, against Vince Russo. Because in TNA, they're no better with this shit in terms of making the women look bad. It always gets me that you have these guys who work for these wrestling companies backstage who probably didn't get laid until they were 40, 45 years old. I'm sure when they finally got laid, they couldn't get it up, you know. So they have all this pent-up angst, and they have all this pent-up aggression towards women. You know, they were probably the in high school who couldn't get a woman if his life depended on it and probably got mocked and ridiculed by them. And all of a sudden, they're a grown adult, and they're a 40-something, 50-something, 60-something-year-old male, and they think all this shit is so much fun. It's their time for revenge. You know, let's make these women look as bad as we can possibly make them look. Let's mock them for being the bitches that they are. You know, every diva or every knockout has to look and sound and dress like a slut. You know, like they would be hanging out on 42nd Street back in the day in New York City. And I just don't understand it. You know, for a company where you have the former CEO who has run for Senate and will run again. Linda McMahon will run again. And all of this shit can come back and bite them on the ass. So just from the perspective of being smart about this stuff, why in God's name would you continue to do shit like this? Is it really necessary to go on TV and criticize every diva who weighs more than 100 pounds? I don't know. It shouldn't bother me. I admit that. It shouldn't bother me. But it pissed me off so much on Monday night, and it still has me angry. I mean, if you want to say it's a storyline, hey, Solid Monster, calm down. It's a storyline. Well, you've got two or three of the same storylines apparently running at the same time because they just seem to criticize everybody about the same thing. It's not a storyline. It's a pattern. It's bullshit. I don't want to hear that. Because it's stupid. It's not true. There's nothing wrong with the way these women look. In fact, I think a lot of them look better than some of the other stick figures on the roster. You have Jerry Lawler going on TV and talking about the Nexus initiation. You know, when they did that 2 weeks ago and they had CM Punk, he was going to initiate the members of Nexus. If they wanted to be a part of the group, they would submit themselves to being lashed with a whip, or being beaten up by everybody else, or hitting each other with a kendo stick or whatever. And WWE went out of their way to make sure that on commentary, maybe just to cover their ass, because they know they have a lot of kids watching, it's a TV PG product, I don't know, but they had Jerry Lawler go out of his way that week, and even this past week, he made another comment about this, that basically all the kids out there watching, if you're ever going to be part of some sort of group or some sort of gang that requires an initiation, it's not worth it. Just say no. I mean, it read like a public service announcement when Lawler would do this. It sounded so forced. But you know what? Whatever. They know they have a lot of kids watching. It's a noble thing on their part to try to get that in there. But they went out of their way to do it. And yet, with the women, it just seems like they're playing to a completely... They're marching to a completely different drummer here. They think it's perfectly fine to go on TV when there's, I'm sure, kids watching, and even they have a lot of females who watch their TV show as well. Probably young females, too. It's perfectly fine to go on TV, though, and poke fun at and mock you know, some of the divas who look perfectly fine, you know, and they're baby faces too. It's not even like it's a heel and it's just fun, like when Molly Holly was on the roster and they made fun of her for having a big ass and wearing granny panties. That was also stupid, to be honest with you, but it became part of her character. It was one storyline they were doing at the time with this one diva. And I think maybe that's what gets at me. It's not just limited to Natty. It's been done with Vicky. It was done with Mickey. It'll be done again in the future. And it's the same stupid people doing the same stupid shit. It's so immature. These people never grew up. Like I said, in some cases, they probably never got laid. And so they think it's fun and it's hilarious to do this. And I just think it's fucking pathetic. And I've said my piece. I've spent more time on this than I wanted to. But that's how I felt. So there you go. I don't know if anybody else felt the same way. But yeah, that shit has to stop. Just a few other thoughts on Raw. I'm not a fan of them booking a champion against champion match in the middle of the show. I mean, you've got your WWE champion against the World Heavyweight Champion. I mean, this is a match that, I mean, you could potentially build this as a WrestleMania main event one day. Champion against champion, title for title. And you've got these two guys going against each other. It's a non-title match, but this is only your secondary main event on the show. You must have John Cena in the main event. I don't know. Anyway, the thing about Edge and Miz that was kind of sad, people didn't give a fuck about this match. I mean, they were sitting on their hands. Maybe at the end they came alive a little bit, I don't know, but they just did not seem into this match at all, and it was so sad. It was just really sad that you have your two world champions in a match, one-on-one, against each other, and nobody seemed to care at all. Edge looked awful in this match. I think he's looked... I mean, Edge had what I thought was a really good match with Kane on SmackDown, Last Man Standing, a couple of weeks ago, and I'll give Edge most of the credit for that match, more so than Kane. It's not that Edge can't have good matches. I understand he's beat up. I mean, the guy has suffered a lot of injuries in the last couple of years. When he suffered that Achilles rupture, that perhaps was the most serious injury of all, maybe except for the neck injury all those years ago, because... You know, your Achilles, that's an injury that some people sometimes will not even come back from. It affects sports players more so, I think, than wrestlers, because if you're a football player and you rupture or tear your Achilles, you will probably never be the same again as far as, for example, your speed. And speed is a lot more important in baseball or football than it is in pro wrestling. Edge doesn't have to do, you know, run laps around the ring. But, you know, even since Edge came back, you can tell he's lost a step or two. He's beat up. He needs more time off. He's getting older. You know, there were rumors going around that, oh, Edge is going to retire in 2 years, which I love because Edge never actually said that he was going to retire in 2 years. But, of course, all the websites, you know, they eat that shit up. But to me, Edge just looks tired. He looks old. He looks run down. He looks like he needs another break. Did not look impressive to me in this match at all. He just doesn't move well. And I know why it is. But he ain't looking too good. Let me talk about this Ric Flair stuff just really quickly here. I know since this happened, Ric Flair apparently rejoined TNA on the European tour in Scotland, and he apologized to the locker room backstage. So I guess all is well. But still, I could not help but read about this story and just think, this is a story that is not going to have a happy ending, which is a shame because Ric Flair is... A lot of people would tell you that Ric Flair is the best wrestler of all time. There are wrestlers that will tell you that Ric Flair is the best wrestler of all time. Triple H, Shawn Michaels, these people will tell you. Steve Austin would all vote Ric Flair as the best wrestler of all time. And there's no reason for the best wrestler of all time to be hitting people up for money and, you know, going around being the nature boy when he's going to be 61 or 62 years old. It's just sad. You know, so I read about what happened, and PW Insider, actually, you know, in some of their reports, they had received, I guess, an email or a detailed account from a TNA talent that wanted to remain anonymous. And, you know, some of what they said, and I'll quote some of it here. The whole thing was stupid, but most of us feel more sorry for him than upset. If someone told you everyone is mad, that's a lie. But there are some people pissed off because it makes the entire crew look like assholes, and we certainly are tired of his shit. Flair has asked several of us for money when he's had his credit cards declined. When that happens, the bar tab comes and others get stuck paying for the very drinks that he said were on the house in the first place. Everyone loves the Nature Boy, but when the limousines and party lifestyle is based on bad credit and lies, it suddenly becomes more pathetic than anything else. There is nothing glamorous about a guy who has no concept of money management and then lies to try and get out of it. The fact that he has no money should be a lesson every wrestler today should take note of. Don't let this happen to you. So, I hear this, and this is coming from apparently a TNA wrestler. I trust PW Insider when they say that. And it's sad. I don't really know what else to say about it. I mean, Flair has always lived a very large, very grand lifestyle. He lived the gimmick, and he never stopped. And the fact is, Ric Flair is on, what, his fourth wife now? He has at least three ex-wives that he has to pay alimony to. And I remember reading that the amount of alimony he is required by law, by the courts, to pay each month comes to a total of over $20,000. And that's just for alimony alone on a monthly basis. That does not take into account the lifestyle that he lives, the cars that he drives, the things that he buys. You know, now he's with another woman. I don't know if they're married or not. If they're not, they probably will be soon, but how much longer could this go on for? Ric Flair, you know what Ric Flair reminds me of? And this is the perfect week to make this analogy. Ric Flair is like the pro wrestling version of Charlie Sheen. I swear to God, if you got Ric Flair and Charlie Sheen together, if Ric Flair and Charlie Sheen came to me and said, Solid Monster, I want you to party with us one night, you could forget any more sound-offs in the future, because I would not survive 6 hours with the two of them. You know, we heard about Charlie Sheen again. He's in the news this past week. He was rushed to the hospital. He had some sort of, I guess he either had an existing hernia that he aggravated, or he suffered a hernia, and his friends were saying that it was because he was laughing too hard at the TV, which is laughable in and of itself if you actually believe in that bullshit. You know, Charlie Sheen is holed up in his mansion, apparently with a briefcase full of bricks of cocaine, smoking crack, supposedly, and having these orgies with all these porn stars, and, getting all drunk and liquored up and shit. I mean, it sounds like he's having a blast. And it makes me wonder, you know, Charlie Sheen, he moved up a couple of notches in my death pool. I don't see how this guy is going to live another 10 years at this point. He even looks older. He looks fucking terrible compared to how he used to look. He looks like he's lost 30 pounds. And yet, he's the highest paid TV... I mean, he's also been in movies, but he's the highest paid TV actor in the country. He makes $2 million an episode on Two and a Half Men. $2 million an episode. It's good to know where the money is going. Ric Flair does not have that sort of income coming in. I don't know what TNA is paying him, but it's not $2 million per episode of Impact. It's not even $2 million a year. But Ric Flair is a guy who has always lived a certain lifestyle. It's the only way he knows. It's what he's known for. Ric Flair has fun when he goes out and he parties and he drinks and he carouses with women and he gets married and he gets divorced and he gets married and he gets divorced and then he drinks some more. And apparently the big difference between Ric Flair and Charlie Sheen is that Charlie Sheen, as destructive as that guy is, he's got the money to do whatever he wants. He wants to spend money on bricks of cocaine? Go for it. I can't believe he's not in jail. I think that's a joke. But he wants to do it? Fine. He wants to spend money on hookers? Be my guest. The sad thing about Ric Flair is he doesn't even have the money to do it. He doesn't have the money. He doesn't have the resources to do it. He had to pawn a lot of his stuff, you know, not long after he retired. I think it might have been before he went to TNA. You know, he's still in litigation with High Spots over possession of the original NWA Championship belt, the NWA belt that he had on Raw with him when he was promoting his WrestleMania match with Shawn Michaels. He does not own that belt anymore. He put it up as collateral and apparently didn't pay his debts, and now the belt is just in limbo somewhere. The NWA belt. Now the guy is maxing out his credit cards. He's trying to hit people up for money. it is well known in the past that he has gone to promoters like Jim Crockett when he worked for the NWA. Flair had a lot of tax problems. He could have been in a lot of trouble. He needed Crockett to help get him out of that. Flair went to Vince McMahon and asked him for some help. He had some issues, money issues. He needed a loan or something. And Vince helped him. Vince didn't have to do that. So this whole story to me is just sad. And I love Ric Flair. I mean, as a performer, he's great. I watched Ric Flair on Impact on Thursday night, and he was entertaining as hell, but I can't even understand what the guy is saying anymore. I heard him use the word dumbass about 24 times when he was talking about Kurt Angle and the other guy. I don't even know who that is. I think he's British. But, it's just, I don't see the story having a happy ending. How does the Ric Flair story end happily? Ric Flair is incapable of having a real retirement and just enjoying his time off and finding a lady friend and settling down and just relaxing in his twilight years. He can't do that. He can't do it. So how does this story end? When does it end? I don't know. Shawn Michaels wants Ric Flair at the Hall of Fame ceremony in April. And my gut tells me, if I were a betting man, he will not be there. Because I don't even know that TNA would let him. I know in the past, TNA has not allowed their stars to be at the Hall of Fame, even though some of them have gone anyway. And even if he went, I don't know that WWE would put him on camera. But I know Shawn Michaels does want him there, so I guess we'll see if he goes. We'll see if he's allowed to attend. All right, so it's time to break back into this Facebook mailbag that I started last week. Again, it just overflowed with questions. And I'm going to try to run through the rest of them this week, and it might even spill over into next week here. So bear with me. But Lewis wrote in and wanted to know, Solid Monster, what are your top five or favorite feuds of the last 25 years? Which is a loaded question, but I just jotted a couple of them down here. Randy Savage and Jake Roberts is one of my all-time favorite feuds. It almost felt like it didn't really have much of a conclusion. It was very brief. It was just a couple of months. Most people may not even remember it, but it was an awesome, awesome feud. And if you go back and find clips of it on YouTube, on Jake's DVD or Macho Man's DVD, go back and watch. And, you know, there's certain incidents like the wedding after party when Savage and Elizabeth got married and the snake popped out of the box. That's essentially what started it. The snake bite incident, of course, has just been something that has just blown up as a huge legend over the years. It's a legendary angle that came at a time in WWF when it was almost like WWF was PG, just kind of like it is now, maybe even more so. You had all these cartoon characters, and you were very limited in what you could do on TV. This was an angle that pushed the boundaries of PG back in 1991, if you go back and watch that snake bite stuff. I loved the intensity. It felt like a real feud. You know, when Jake slapped Elizabeth in the face at Tuesday in Texas, which was it was a pay-per-view experiment they did, having a pay-per-view on a Tuesday back in 91. And when he smacked Elizabeth in the face and Gorilla Monsoon goes crazy and says that he should be suspended for life and Bobby Heenan is going nuts and the President Jack Tunney comes out to kind of break things up. Great, 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 great stuff. One of my all-time favorite feuds. Steve Austin and The Rock had a lot of great matches. They had a great feud. I'm more of a fan of the Austin-Rock stuff from 98 into 99, more so than the stuff that came later on. I think that was a fantastic feud. Obviously, Steve Austin and Vince McMahon, one of the all-time great WWF feuds that helped turn the company around. Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker have had a great feud, and it goes back to 1997. You know, they were two top guys in the company that never had a match. They never had a program with each other. And the first match they had was on pay-per-view. It was called Ground Zero. And they had a great match. And they followed it up the next month with the very first Hell in a Cell match, which, of course, is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Hell in a Cell match WWE has ever had. And they had another match. I wasn't as impressed by the casket match at the Rumble. That was where Shawn suffered his back injury, and the feud kind of ended at that point. And even if you then pick up where it left off, you know, when Shawn and Undertaker were going head-to-head at WrestleMania 25 that first time, the build-up to that match was so good. And the build-up to their match at WrestleMania 26, streak versus career, and the video packages, and, you know, Michaels playing mind games on The Undertaker, which is unusual since it's usually The Undertaker playing mind games on Shawn Michaels. Just great, great, great stuff. They have great chemistry together, great matches, and Michaels and Undertaker has to be up there. Bret Hart and Steve Austin had a great feud as well. I'll never forget, it was at a pay-per-view. Austin was doing a promo with Brian Pillman in the ring and Owen Hart, and they were ragging on Bret Hart, who at the time had not come back. This was in September of 96 at the, I believe, the Mind Games pay-per-view, which would have been in Philadelphia. And Bret Hart was about a month or so away from making the announcement that he was returning to WWE. He had not been seen or heard from much since the Iron Man match at WrestleMania that year. And Austin is trying to goad Bret Hart into coming back. He wants Bret Hart to come back in the worst way so he can have a match with him. And he's at the pay-per-view doing this promo in the ring, and he says, you know, if you put the letter S in front of Hitman, you've got exactly my thoughts on Bret Hart. I thought that was a great line. Bret came back. They had a great match at Survivor Series. Austin screwed him over in the Royal Rumble. They had one of the all-time great matches at WrestleMania 13. They had a great brawl after WrestleMania a couple weeks later where Austin beat the shit out of Bret with a chair, attacked him in an ambulance. They had another match on pay-per-view after that. Great. And one of Bret's, and Bret will tell you this if you ask him, and he said this in interviews, that it was one of his favorite feuds as well. And I'll throw the NWO against WCW in there too. I'll throw that in there because at the beginning it was just a magnificent storyline. You know, when you had Hogan, Hall, Nash, even when they added X-Pac and the Giant. Before the NWO got way out of control, where basically everybody and their mother, literally, Judy Bagwell, when everybody and their mother joined the NWO, before that happened, it was great. You had, you know, 3, 4, 5 guys feuding with the top 3, 4, 5 guys from WCW. The War Games match that year in 96 at Fall Brawl, I remember as being pretty damn good. At the beginning, it was a great storyline and a great feud that just got way out of control. Sometime later in 1997 or into 98, you know, it went to hell in a handbasket. But at the beginning, great stuff. Miguel writes in. He just finished reading The Death of WCW, which is a fantastic book, by the way. If you have not read it, I would urge everybody listening to this to pick up a copy or get it on your Kindle or whatever you have to do. It's a great, and it's a very entertaining read as well, by R.D. Reynolds, I should say, of WrestleCrap fame, and Brian Alvarez. But anyway, the book got him thinking, when Bischoff and Russo rebooted WCW in 2000, do you think a brand split a la Raw vs. SmackDown between Nitro and Thunder would have been more beneficial to the product than the direction they ended up taking? I think having that would have made the product better because of the massive talent pool they had at the time. It also would have reinvigorated Thunder, which had become a joke by then. Look, anything would have been better than what they did because they went out of fucking business. Anything would have been better. I don't know. You say they had a massive talent pool. I will not deny that WCW had a lot of talent on their roster at the time, a lot of talent that they were not using or using to the best of their abilities. Although at that point, a lot of guys had already left. You know, Jericho was gone. Benoit was gone. Eddie Guerrero was gone. Dean Malenko was gone. You know, the Giants was gone. A lot of people had already jumped ship to the WWF. But they still had a lot of talent. I won't deny that. I don't know that a roster split would have been the way to go. I think just, you know, getting rid of the nonsensical booking, putting a greater focus on the younger guys. I mean, Thunder was a joke at that point. Quite frankly, I think Thunder didn't help WCW. I know Thunder was a highly rated show at first, but I think Thunder, and more so than Thunder, I mean, Nitro going to 3 hours is what also helped do the company in at the end of the day. I don't know that a roster split would have been the way to go if I were running things, but in reality, anything would have been better because what they did sucked. Go back and try to watch WCW during 2000 or at least late 2000 into 2001. I won't even say late 2000. You watch WCW from even late 99 until the day they died in 2001. That company fucking sucked. Their TV show was unwatchable. It reminded me of Impact in how bad it was. It was an awful, awful television show. Anything would have been better than that booking that Russo gave that company at that time. The way he booked that company into oblivion. It's a sin. It's a sin that WCW did not survive and is not around today. And the groundwork for what happened was laid years earlier. You know, overdoing it with the NWO angle, not pushing the younger guys when you still had them under contract, the guys like the Jerichos and the Guerreros and the Benoits and all that stuff. But so the groundwork was already laid. The company was going to be in dire straits, I should say, no matter what. The company could have been saved. But 2000 into 2001, it was such an awful year for that company. Their TV shows were just... It was like a comedy of horrors is what it was. So anything would have been better. John wants to know, have you ever heard of any real fights that have ever happened in the ring? Like two wrestlers, for example, who get so upset they end up really hurting each other. Well, that happens all the time. I mean, you can probably find a lot of examples over the years. You and I have no idea. I mean, a lot of people probably don't even know. I'm sure there's been a lot of fights that we couldn't even tell that these guys were really stiffing each other. And sometimes you watch matches and you just know that these guys are really laying it into each other. I mean, Vader used to have matches, and I remember a match between Vader and it might have been Vader and Stan Hansen, actually, in Japan. It was the match that you could find on YouTube where Vader's eye popped out of his head, or his eye socket got turned inside out. It was disgusting, whatever it was. His eye basically was bugging out of his head. You could find it on YouTube. That's an example of a match, I think, where these guys were roughing each other up, and, you know, one person kind of gets a little angry or a little carried away, and then the other guy just starts laying in the shots. And the other guy might like that. I mean, Stan Hansen, he probably would have loved that. You could find numerous examples of it. I can't name any from, like, WWF, any recent examples off the top of my head. It's a lot less likely that shit like that would happen in today's WWE, for example. I mean, I'm almost positive there's been examples of this in the past. You know, it's just I can't name any specific examples other than maybe the Vader one off the top of my head. Kevin wants to know, what do I think would have happened if Rey Mysterio had not broken The Undertaker's nose last year? I heard they were building towards a Jack Swagger title match defending the belt against Undertaker at SummerSlam. Maybe this would have made Swagger a lot better than he is now. Sooners are MVPs, not dweebs coming out with mascots. I don't remember hearing Undertaker Swagger as a plan for SummerSlam. I remember Ray. What happened was Ray was having a match on TV with Undertaker, and his knee brace, I think, hit him in the face. Undertaker was bleeding. Yeah, I think his nose was broken. I don't remember him being out for that long. I mean, a broken nose is not going to keep the Undertaker out of action for very long. He's got more serious injuries to worry about. Plus, when Undertaker had his orbital bone cracked by King Mabel in late 95, he came back not long after that wearing a white Phantom of the Opera-like mask over his face. He wore this weird apparatus over his face, and the reason he wore it was they weren't trying to make him into some sort of Count Dracula type of character or, you know, Phantom or anything, but it was to protect his face because his orbital bone still had not healed. And there have been wrestlers that have broken noses and have worn apparatus on their face to protect their noses, and they can still continue working. So if there was a plan like that and Undertaker broke his nose, I don't think they would have changed plans to that degree just because Undertaker broke his nose. Undertaker's a tough guy. He can live with that. Speaking of Undertaker, here's an interesting question from Aaron. When the Undertaker goes into the Hall of Fame, how do you think he will go in? As the Undertaker from the past or current Dead Man character? Maybe the American Badass or just Mark Calloway as a person? Just wondering this because everyone wears a tuxedo at the Hall of Fame. I just cannot see the Undertaker wearing a tuxedo when he's inducted into the Hall of Fame. It's not so much that I can't picture the Undertaker wearing a tuxedo. I think I've actually seen him wearing a tuxedo before. I've seen, I think it was from wedding pictures when he married Sarah. But I see The Undertaker going into the Hall of Fame as himself. I'm not saying he's going to be introduced as Mark Calloway, but he'll be a normal human being. He's not going to be the Dead Man. He's not going to be the American Badass with a bandana wrapped around his head. He'll be more like the American Badass in that he'll be able to speak and sound like a normal person. You know, he's not going to come out and do light tricks and talk in that deep, gravelly voice. I think he'll go in like a normal person, reflecting back on his career. You know, the Hall of Fame is not about gimmicks and bullshit like that. The Hall of Fame is about recounting the careers of the people who are being inducted. All the different incarnations of The Undertaker will be covered in his induction video. And it's not like we haven't heard The Undertaker speak like a normal person before. You know what I mean? When The Undertaker is retired, because he ain't going to go into the Hall of Fame until he is done and done for good. When he is in the Hall of Fame, that means he is done for good. There's no reason to protect kayfabe anymore, to protect the character. There's nothing left to protect. You're done. You're finished. You know, you don't have to worry about that anymore. It's the same reason, you know, when Owen Hart died, and the next night on Raw, they had all the wrestlers come out for a tribute. The only reason The Undertaker didn't come out, because he was there that night. The only reason he didn't come out was because he had to protect his character. And I think part of it might have also been, in fairness, and I don't know this, but I don't know how appropriate it would have been to have a character called The Undertaker coming out when a wrestler just died. That might be a little, you know, that might come off a little tasteless. But, you know, the real reason was he was protecting his character. I think it was the same thing when other wrestlers have died and they've had similar things. So I see The Undertaker going in as a normal guy. They're not going to call him Mark, but he'll go in as close to being himself as he can possibly go in. I think he'll take the stage, he'll thank a lot of people, he'll talk about the different incarnations of his character, and reflect back on a 20-plus year career. You know, it's a very impressive thing that he's been able to pull off. You know, he's a big guy, he's been beaten up for years. I mean, I remember hearing reports of Undertaker having bad hips and bad knees in the mid-90s, and it's 2011, and the guy barely, but the guy is still going. I mean, I can't think of too many people in WWE that have had as remarkable a career as The Undertaker has had. Not just because of the duration of it. You can have a job guy on the roster for 20 years, but he's done it at a high level. You know, he seemed to, almost like a fine wine, he seemed to get better with age. You know, Undertaker had so many goddamn shitty matches in the 90s. And it was not just his fault. I mean, he had a lot of bad opponents, whether it was the Giant Gonzalez or Yokozuna or Mr. Hughes or King Kong Bundy or Mabel. You know, and it's not to say guys like Yokozuna weren't great talents, but he worked with all these big guys. You can only do so much with them. He's very limited in what he can do. And we started to see in the later years when Undertaker would be in the ring with guys like Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and Kurt Angle. And even guys who were not necessarily as talented as them. You know, it would be really easy to say, oh, of course, Undertaker can have a great match. Anybody could have a great match with Shawn Michaels. But he had a lot of great matches with a lot of different guys as he got older. You know, his best WrestleMania matches for all of the Mania matches he's had have been in the last 2 years. Undertaker has never had a better match at WrestleMania. He has never had a better opponent at WrestleMania than he has had in Shawn Michaels. And he's had good matches. He had a good match with Triple H, good match with Ric Flair, good match with Randy Orton, good match with Batista, good match with Edge. But it's pretty remarkable what he's been able to do. And the unfortunate flip side to all this is that he is, at the age of 47, I believe he is, maybe going on 48. You know, he's getting up there in years. He's almost 50, but by no means is 47 or 48 years old. To an athlete, I guess you could say it is, but the flip side of Undertaker is physically just completely destroyed. And once he does decide to hang it up, I'm sure he'll need one or two hip replacements. I know his hips have been giving him problems for a long, long time. And when he goes into the Hall of Fame, he shouldn't have to worry about keeping, you know, kayfabe and protecting the character. Everybody knows it's just a character. He should be able to take the stage and just say thanks, you know, for being honored in such a way. And I can't think of a better person to induct Undertaker into the Hall of Fame than Paul Bearer. You know, Paul Bearer is a good friend of his, and he managed him for 6 years straight, managed him a little more later on in his career. And, you know, I look forward to that day. When Undertaker goes into the Hall of Fame, you know, if I'm booking WWE, if Undertaker is reaching the end of his rope here, if he can make WrestleMania this year, he goes to 19-0, if you can push him to WrestleMania next year, which I believe is going to be in Toronto, he can go 20-0 next year. Let him go 20-0 in 2012 against John Cena. And then wait 2 years let 2 years go by. And then you're back at Madison Square Garden. You're back in New York City. WrestleMania's 30th... Well, I guess technically it's not the 30th anniversary, but it's WrestleMania 30. That, to me, would be the best time to put Undertaker in the Hall of Fame. If I had control over the rest of this guy's career, if he can make it, if he can handle it, he goes 20-0 next year, retires at WrestleMania, goes into the Hall of Fame at WrestleMania 30 2 years later. That's how I book the end of the Undertaker's story career. Christopher wants to know, what was my favorite WWE, WCW, ECW, or TNA opening theme? I would assume by that you mean to one of their TV shows. If so, I would probably go with The Beautiful People by Marilyn Manson when they had that as the SmackDown theme many years ago. It's just, I don't know, it's just a great song, you know, great beat, got me into the show, got my blood pumping, and yeah, I'd probably go with that first. All right, let's see here. Antonio writes in, and this came from, this message. Well, these messages were left before the football games last week, and he says, from one of your tweets, you seem to be a New York Jets fan. I like the Jets, but the Steelers are going to beat their ass this Sunday. Ha ha. You know what? Then I'm not going to read your letter, so let's just move on. Matt writes in. He says, on my last podcast, which might have actually at this point been a couple of weeks ago, I mentioned that I see steel cage matches as pointless unless someone bleeds. I don't think I said that in those exact words, but anyway, he said that I said that cage matches are pointless unless someone bleeds. Other than since becoming PG-13, the only cage match I can remember where no superstar bled was Owen Hart versus Bret Hart. That would have been at SummerSlam 94. Is there any other cage match that you can recall that a superstar did not bleed in the ring? Well, there's been plenty of cage matches where there's been no blood. Again, I never said that every single steel cage match has to have blood or it means nothing. That wasn't, or if it came off that way, that wasn't exactly the point I was trying to make. But there have been plenty of cage matches. And like you said, Bret and Owen, that's a great example to give because Bret versus Owen is the best steel cage match I've ever seen. And it had no blood. It was a 32-minute match. It was a long match. It was a great match. At SummerSlam 94, all the Hart family members were sitting at ringside in Chicago. And there was not an ounce of blood. There was a lot of brutality in that match. That old blue bar steel cage, which is my favorite version of it, that hurt, for real. That hurt a lot. And I think that's a big part of why they did away with it. But those cages were so much easier. I think the bigger guys like Hogan and stuff like that, those cages, other than the mesh fence, were a lot easier to climb. So that's why I think also they were using them. But other than Bret and Owen, I mean, I know there have been plenty of cage matches just on TV alone. TV cage matches. You know, Bret Hart and Psycho Sid on Raw the week before WrestleMania 13. There was no blood in that match. I know Rock and Triple H had at least one, if not several, cage matches. I don't know that any of them ever bled in any of those matches. Triple H and Mankind opened SummerSlam 1997 inside of a steel cage. That was when Foley climbed to the top of the blue bar cage and ripped open his shirt to reveal what was supposed to be a Dude Love tattoo, but unfortunately, he had wrestled an entire match and sweated so much that the tattoo was almost invisible. And he came off the top with an elbow smash. There was no blood in that cage match. So you can come up with a lot of examples of steel cage matches that did not have blood and that were very good. Noah writes in, not Noah Mark, Noah Wing. What indie wrestlers do you see as having the potential to find a place for themselves with either WWE or TNA in 2011? This can include any talents that aren't working for one of those two promotions right now. My list would include either the Kings of Wrestling, the American Wolves, El Generico, maybe Jimmy Jacobs, and as a dark horse, perhaps Chuck Taylor. Who do you think? All very good choices. I agree with everybody except Jimmy Jacobs. Jimmy Jacobs is a talented guy, but if you're asking me do I see him in WWE or TNA in 2011, absolutely not. Jimmy Jacobs, by the way, for those of you who don't know, was in WWE briefly. He did one shot with them a couple of years ago. This would have been back in 2004 or 5. And he was on SmackDown, and he had a match with Eddie Guerrero. And I think Jimmy Jacobs has told this story before, probably after Eddie died. And I guess at the time the story was, I don't remember what was going on with Eddie Guerrero's character, but he was upset. He was angry. He was on the warpath. And you know, I think Jimmy has told the story where he was backstage and he, you know, introduced himself to Eddie Guerrero, and Eddie was like, you know, we're going to work together tonight, and I just want you to know that, you know, no hard feelings for what I'm going to do. Or maybe he apologized to him in advance, because it called for Eddie to really stiff him. I mean, Eddie was going to beat the crap out of him on this night, and he did. And a lot of people forget that Jimmy Jacobs had a match on SmackDown with Eddie Guerrero before Eddie died. So, El Generico had a tryout match, I believe, with TNA recently. I don't know one way or the other if they were impressed by him or not. The American Wolves, Kings of Wrestling. Kings of Wrestling, to me, are the biggest example. And actually, I shouldn't even say that. Charlie Haas and Shelton Benjamin is a great example of how the people in these two major companies have their heads so far up their asses, it's not even funny. The fact that Haas and Benjamin had to go to ROH to get work on the national scene, and they'll be allowed to have much better matches in Ring of Honor than they would in WWE, which has zero fucking tag teams right now. But it's a shame that teams like them and the Kings of Wrestling have to wrestle at a lower level when those guys could be main eventing real wrestling pay-per-views. They really could be main eventing a WWE pay-per-view. I mean, Chris Hero, Claudio Castagnoli, even as singles acts, not just as a tag team, because they're single stars as well. Very talented guys. You know, Claudio was actually being called up to the roster once, and then there was some sort of issue with his visa, which eventually got resolved, and WWE never bothered to bring him back. They never gave him another look. I still to this day don't know what the hell that's about. I mean, the guy got all those issues resolved. All of a sudden you're not interested in him anymore? He's got the size that you're looking for. He's an international guy. I don't know. So, if Kings of Wrestling were to get the nod from WWE, or TNA, I guess, but I wouldn't want them in TNA. But that's more me being selfish. Those guys deserve to be wrestling on national television for a major promotion, a major number one or number two promotion. The Briscoes are also a very talented team, but they just re-signed, with Ring of Honor. And to be honest, I don't think Jay and Mark Briscoe would do very well in the PG WWE. Even if they adapted and they did fine, part of the Briscoes' charm is foul language and beer drinking and just, you know, going in there and just smashing whoever they're in the ring with. And I don't think that would fly too well in WWE. But another indie guy, just before I move on to the next question here that you didn't mention that I think you should watch out for, Ricochet. Go find a Ricochet match on YouTube. This guy is impressive. Shaber writes in, I hope I pronounced that correctly. If not, I apologize. Michael Cole quite often calls the Nexus the most dominating faction in the history of WWE, which we all know is not true. In my opinion, I think Evolution was much more dominating, so I wanted to know which faction you consider to be the most dominating faction in WWE history. If we're talking WWE, I have to think a little harder about that. Evolution would be a good choice. DX was entertaining. I don't know that DX was ever dominating. The Hart Foundation, you know, You know what? I would put the Hart Foundation right up there along with Evolution. But I would broaden the question a little bit, because if you're asking the most dominant faction in wrestling history, as much as I love the Four Horsemen, you have to go with the NWO. You just have to. I mean, just the nature of how they were booked. They went out there for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, for months and months and months on end, and just absolutely dominated the babyfaces. They never gave the babyfaces an opportunity. You know, and if the babyfaces were to beat them up 1 week, they would come right back the next week and they would just dominate them all over again. And it got to the point where they dominated so much, it ended up working against them. But just by the nature of how they were booked and for the length of time that they were on top, I don't see how there could be any answer other than the original. And by original, I mean the non-WWE version of the New World Order. Bethany wants to know, do I think the Steiner brothers will ever make the WWE Hall of Fame? And also, do I think Buff Bagwell has a chance to ever make a comeback? Now, if I remember correctly, I think Bethany is a Buff Bagwell fan. So I will be diplomatic in how I answer this question. I'll answer the second question first. No, Buff Bagwell is not going to be coming back to WWE. He is, I don't believe, going to be coming back to TNA. You sure as shit will never see him in Ring of Honor. And quite frankly, that's the way it should be. I know you're a Buff Bagwell fan, but
No.
His time has come and gone. As far as the Steiner brothers are concerned, absolutely. They have to be in the WWE Hall of Fame at some point. You know, Scott Steiner and Rick Steiner, when they were together as a team in the late 80s, the early 90s, in the NWA, and even in the WWF, they had some great friggin' matches. They were a great tag team. They were the epitome of what tag team wrestling was all about. You had two legitimate real-life brothers from the University of Michigan, two great wrestlers who watched each other's backs, who were big, tough, strong guys that could actually get in there and wrestle. Scott could wrestle. Rick could wrestle, but he was more of the brawler. Scott was very impressive when he would do that Frankensteiner. Unfortunately, you know, he fucked up his neck. He would fuck himself up physically by doing that move for so many years. But great tag team. One of the all-time great tag teams, in fact. Just like the Road Warriors should be in the Hall of Fame, and they will be. And even Demolition should be in the Hall of Fame, and they will be. The Steiner Brothers belong in there as well. It's just a matter, I think, of when and not if. Zach writes in, what do you think of a Jake the Snake Roberts versus Undertaker rematch from the past for WrestleMania? Roberts is retiring anyway, so last match versus streak, or career versus streak. Great way for WWE to show some appreciation for Jake the Snake. I know it wouldn't be the same as the past, but it would just be so awesome to say that I saw this match in 2011. I can think of a million different words that I would likely say out loud if I had to see a Jake Roberts versus Undertaker match in 2011. Awesome is not one of them. I am a big Jake the Snake fan. I saw an interview with him recently, and I know he has said that he has two books coming out. He's going to be doing a book on his career and his life, and he's actually going to be working on a second book with his daughter about addiction. Obviously, he has a lot of experience with addiction, and I think that's great. I think that's a wonderful thing for him to be doing. He seems to be on the straight and narrow, but we've been down this road before. Just like Scott Hall. Scott Hall just did an interview with a newspaper. He is mentoring the former Ricky Ortiz. He's kind of taken him under his wing. And he did an interview and said that he's been in and out of rehab 9 times. And he's actually headed back to the Menninger Clinic, I think in Houston, which is actually like a psychiatric hospital. He's identified some issues that he's had from when he was a kid. Again, Jake and Scott Hall, I once did a podcast about these two guys, and I said Jake the Snake was going to be dead within 5 years. We're still in that time frame. I hope that I don't want Jake to die, but you know, we've heard this story before from these guys. You hope that they've got their lives back on track and they realize that it's just not worth it. As a performer, Jake the Snake Roberts should have stopped wrestling probably 10 years ago. I've seen Jake wrestle matches on the independent circuit. I've seen video of those matches, and it's not pretty. And Jake is getting older. He's in his 50s. His body has just been ravaged with injuries, but also he hasn't treated his body very well. I believe he had part of his foot amputated, which I was not aware of. Jake the Snake Roberts does not need to be wrestling The Undertaker at WrestleMania. They had a match at WrestleMania 8, okay, almost a full 20 years ago, and even that match wasn't great. I love that match, by the way, at WrestleMania 8. It wasn't a great match or anything. It was actually pretty quick. It was maybe 5 or 6 minutes. But, you know, that was a match that helped get Undertaker over big time. And I don't think Jake was too thrilled about doing the job, but Undertaker just basically dominated Jake the Snake in that match. And Jake was gone from the company right after that. But it's not as though the match they had 20 years ago was all that great. What makes you think that 20 years later, when Jake has had part of his foot removed and is 50-something years old, that he can have even a decent match with The Undertaker as broken down as The Undertaker is? I can think of matches I would love to see for nostalgia. Jake and The Undertaker? No. That's not a good idea. Thomas writes in, who would be the best person in management to help TNA move forward, assuming that this person can fire Vince Russo and demote Eric Bischoff? Is it Jim Ross, Paul Heyman, or Gabe Salsaky, the ex-Ring of Honor writer? I don't know who Gabe Salsaky is. Maybe he's the one. We need Gabe Salsaky to help turn TNA around. My vote goes with Gabe Salsaky. If you can find me who Gabe Salsaky is, I would love to know. Now, if you're talking Gabe Sapolsky, he would be a fine choice, too. But I like this Gabe Salsicki guy. Tell me more about him. Steve says, based off the current situation, do you think that most people who get cut from developmental or even NXT will end up trying to make it in MMA? And if so, which people from developmental could you see leaving wrestling to try it? I don't follow the developmental system close enough to know for sure. I mean, there's been a couple of big guys, I guess, that have been on NXT, even Brodus Clay. I have no idea if they have any sort of fighting background or I have no idea. I really don't know. It's kind of a weird question. I mean, now, if you were to ask me who from the current roster do I think could make it in MMA if they wanted to leave wrestling and try it, I mean, that would be maybe an easier question to answer, but even that question is not so easy because look up and down the roster. Do you think a guy like Dolph Ziggler or Randy Orton or The Miz could make it in mixed martial arts? The Undertaker at his age and in his physical condition, could he make it in mixed martial arts? The Big Show? Big as he is, The Big Show ain't going to do very well for himself in mixed martial arts if he doesn't know what he's doing. You don't have a lot of tough guys on the roster, I got to be honest with you. I mean, you know, maybe they're secretly tough backstage, but I look up and down the roster right now, and there is nobody who jumps out at me as being somebody who would be a formidable force to deal with in an MMA ring. You've got big guys. You've got Big Zeke on SmackDown. You've got Mason Ryan on Raw. But big doesn't necessarily mean tough. And there's been a lot of big guys that have gone into MMA and have had their clock cleaned or have been taken down because they got big long legs and they don't really go anywhere. So there's nobody, in all honesty, there's really nobody from the current roster who jumps out at me. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head. There have been guys before, and I think I might have answered this question in an SC Scoops mailbag on the main page. And by the way, the latest mailbag is up. You should check it out from Friday. There's some good stuff in there. But there have been legit tough guys and you know, Class A, Division A athletes that have been in and out of the wrestling business over the years. The late Dr. Death, Steve Williams, Big Van Vader, even Haku. Haku is known, he is renowned as being one of the all-time toughest, legitimately toughest guys in the wrestling business. Haku, the former Meng in WCW. Would he have done well for himself in MMA? Well, with a little bit of training, he probably could have done pretty well for himself. And you could probably say that about anybody. Anybody with good, decent training over an extended period of time could probably do okay in that they would know the basics and be able to defend themselves. By no means does that mean they would do really well. You know, a guy like Brock Lesnar is a freak of nature. Bobby Lashley, he looked very impressive at first, and then he got beat. And then he didn't look so impressive. You know, just because you're big doesn't make you tough. Richard wants to just cut to the chase here. He asks, why should I give a crap about Dolph Ziggler? WWE has done nothing to make him seem worthy of the World Heavyweight Championship. Well, I won't deny that. They have booked him into a fucking wall. He just crashed into it this past week. I mean, week after week, we've seen Dolph come out and get RKO'd by Randy Orton for no good reason. He got RKO'd again this past week, not once, I think, but twice. You know, Edge speared him. I mean, he just was made to look like a complete dweeb. And I agree. They have booked him very poorly heading into this championship match. But here's why you should give a crap about Dolph Ziggler. Because we need more guys like Dolph Ziggler to break through into the main event. Because a guy like Edge is going to just break down one of these days and have to hang up the tights. Because Triple H is phasing himself out and becoming more of a special attraction, or so he says. Because The Undertaker doesn't have that many matches left in him. Because Kane is over 40 years old, and he doesn't have very good matches anymore. Because The Big Show bores me to fucking tears. Because Rey Mysterio is one knee operation away from going back to Mexico and doing, you know, promotional work for AAA. I mean, we need more guys like Dolph Ziggler to break into the main event scene. I personally am entertained by Dolph Ziggler as a performer. I think he's pretty good. He does more for me than Drew McIntyre. And there's a lot of people out there who love Drew McIntyre. Don't know why. He's got a good look, but he's boring. Dolph Ziggler, I will say this much, he does not come off to me as boring. I don't know why. He doesn't. And we need more guys like that. We need more guys like that wrestling for championships, wrestling in the main events, not just relegated to the mid-card. Ted DiBiase was relegated on Raw to mid-card hell when people had him pegged for being a WrestleMania main eventer within 3 years. What happened? He had his legs cut off. I was in Madison Square Garden in November of 2009 when Kofi Kingston did that big dive on Randy Orton and the Garden went fucking apeshit for him. What happened? They cut his legs off. Good for Kofi. He's the Intercontinental Champion on SmackDown, but he could have been so much more than that. Jack Swagger was a World Heavyweight Champion. And now he runs around with an eagle for a mascot. We don't need more of that. We need more guys getting an opportunity, seizing an opportunity, making the most of it, and proving to management that, hey, you can put your faith in me. I can deliver for you. I can be a main event guy. You know, Vince McMahon looks at a guy like Christian and says, you're not a main event guy. You don't have the physique for it. You don't have the look. You will never be a main event guy. I don't want him to say the same thing about Dolph Ziggler. I don't want him to say the same thing about Jack Swagger or Kofi Kingston or John Morrison. So that's why you should root for Dolph Ziggler. Even if you're not a Dolph Ziggler fan, you could be the biggest edge mark in the world. It doesn't matter. You should root for the guy to do well on Sunday. You should root for the guy to have a good match. You should want to see more guys like him break into the main event, because otherwise, you're part of the problem. You're not part of the solution. You know, you'll lap up whatever WWE shoves down your throat, and you'll wipe your mouth clean, and you'll smile, and you know what? That's bullshit. We don't need more of that. I'm tired of seeing the same thing over and over again. I can only see John Cena versus Randy Orton so many times before my fucking head explodes. That should be reason enough for you to want to see Dolph Ziggler do well. I can't think of a better argument than that. Natin wants to know, what would be a better finishing move for Wade Barrett? Anything would be a better finishing move than that Wasteland move. It's just such a stupid-looking move. If I were him, the problem is you have a lot of guys who do the same move. I find it funny that the same week they basically did the same angle where Big Zeke, they did the big swerve on SmackDown and he ended up joining the core, and then Mason Ryan joined Nexus on Raw. And I think both of them used the same Uranage slam. Everybody uses the same fucking maneuver. I think Heath Slater, you know, the move that he uses is similar to a move that either Dolph Ziggler or somebody else was using. But nonetheless, Wade Barrett can come up with something, I think, a little more creative than that. You know, to me, it doesn't even look like it's all that painful of a move. It's no different than the attitude adjustment. I mean, come on, you could do better than that. I mean, why not a powerbomb? Chris wants to know, what do I think of WWE trying to get Kimbo Slice for WrestleMania? Well, they're not trying to get Kimbo Slice for WrestleMania, so those are my thoughts on that. David wants to know why TNA cannot crank out another video game. It would definitely increase their ratings and revenue. Is that so? Is that so? A video game is going to help TNA's ratings and revenue. Well, it'll help their revenue if they can sell enough copies of the game, but obviously the fact that they never did a second game kind of tells you how the first one did. First one didn't do as well as they were hoping. I'm intrigued by this argument, though, that somehow a second video game will help turn TNA's ratings around. Please explain this to me, because I have never heard this argument used before. I don't think, you know, WWE's video games do pretty damn well, and I don't remember hearing that any of their video games helped their ratings at all. I'm not sure how you came to that conclusion, but it's not going to happen because the first game just didn't do that well. So, and Midway, which I believe released the first game, I believe Midway went into bankruptcy, and they don't exist anymore. So I'm not even sure who might own the TNA video game license. I'm not even sure if that maybe is in limbo or not right now. And the last one we'll get to this week. I got a couple more, but I'll do one more here. What is your favorite pay-per-view? That's what Chris wants to know. WrestleMania is my favorite pay-per-view because it's still the biggest event of the year. Typically, in the past, WrestleMania would be the culmination, the climax of a lot of feuds. Nowadays, that's not entirely true. I think WrestleMania, in some ways, is just another pay-per-view, or it's just an extension of whatever feud is still going on. But it's still, you know, it's a fun show. You know, it's got a lot of matches that you would not ordinarily be able to see. And there's a lot of pomp and a lot of circumstance and a lot of history behind it. But if WrestleMania is my favorite pay-per-view, then Royal Rumble is not that far behind it. And I will be ordering the Royal Rumble this weekend, a rare time that I will be willing to plunk down my my hard-earned money for a WWE pay-per-view. The undercard doesn't impress me at all, so obviously I'm buying the Rumble for the same reason a lot of people are buying the Rumble, and that's for the Rumble match. The only time I ever missed a Rumble match was in 2005 and 2007, and subsequently I did see those matches, but I've seen every other Royal Rumble match, except the one in 1987 that WWE has kind of erased from the record books, that one-man gang one, but... the Rumble is a fun event. I was at the Royal Rumble in 2008 at Madison Square Garden, counting down the entrants. You know, John Cena came out as the big surprise entrant. Roddy Piper and Jimmy Snuka went at it in the Rumble match. Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker started the Rumble that year. That was a lot of fun. Probably more fun probably to be there in person than it is on TV. This year we have a supersized Royal Rumble. It's being billed as the biggest Royal Rumble ever. And like I said earlier, there's bound to be a couple of surprises. I personally would be stunned if Triple H wasn't there. Rumors of Booker T, you know, maybe Bret Hart will make an appearance. But the fact is, the Rumble is one of those shows that it still works. You know, it's one of those gimmicks that still gets me excited. And I'm a hell of a lot more apt to spend money on the Royal Rumble than I am, you know, TLC or Money in the Bank or even Elimination Chamber. And I am looking forward to the show this weekend. I am actually looking forward to a WWE pay-per-view. I hope they can deliver. And I hope they get this WrestleMania build off to the right start. Because if they get some really good promotion behind WrestleMania this year, that would be good for them because they're going to need it. They don't have that one or two, those one or two big matches that you already know in advance are probably going to happen. Like we did with Michaels and Undertaker or Cena Batista. They don't have any of that this year. They're not even sure if Undertaker will be healed in time. They don't even know, you know, we don't even know who the champions are going to be. Both champions may lose their belts by the time the February pay-per-view rolls around. So the build to Mania will begin this weekend, and I hope for their sake that they've got some sort of plan in their head about where they want to go with things. And it's always fun, again, to wonder who's going to win the Rumble. Like I said, my pick, if I had to pick a name, John Cena is the name. But I'm telling you, I'm telling everybody listening right now, you watch for number 21 this weekend. I just have a feeling. This feeling didn't work out too well for me when I went to Atlantic City a couple of months ago. But I got a feeling, number 21, that's my lucky number this weekend. So if you're ordering the Royal Rumble, enjoy the show. Be sure to send in feedback when it's over. You can send questions to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Solomonster. And, of course, friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/TheSolomonster. If you didn't check it out last week, I have a photo library up there called The Secret Files with some photos of the Solomonster. I'll be adding to that in the weeks to come. So if you want to check that out, you must be a friend on Facebook. That's if you needed a reason to join, I can't think of a better one. So... friend me on there, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. That will give you access to all of the photos or videos and whatever other stuff I may put up there in the weeks to come. So definitely check that out. And, of course, subscribe to The Sound Off on iTunes. It's free. Go to the iTunes music store, type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You can subscribe. The podcast will automatically download whenever a new one is posted. Leave me some feedback on there if you would be so kind to do so. And that's going to do it for this weekend. Royal Rumble. Woohoo. I am really excited. It should be a fun show. So again, if you're watching the Rumble, do enjoy. We'll be back next week with your email questions. I promise I will get back to doing email questions on the show now that the Facebook mailbag is winding down. And that'll be episode 145. So until next time, be well, stay safe, enjoy the Rumble, and we'll see you next week.
Let me tell you something, fella. This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SCScoops.com.